is entitled The Most Confidential Knowledge. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur then explains that in going progression of going through the Gita, so this, he says here, the knowledge useful for liberation taught in the second, third, and subsequent chapters is confidential. The knowledge useful for attaining me taught in the seventh, eighth chapters is more confidential. Because by that knowledge, the truth about the personality of Godhead is known. That knowledge is the science of devotional service. In this chapter, however, the word knowledge needs to be interpreted as meaning bhakti. It is not the same knowledge described in the first six chapters. Srila Prabhupada remarks about this. The matters which are described in the ninth chapter deal with unalloyed pure devotion. Therefore, this is called the most confidential. So in the last chapter, Krishna explained about the pure devotee, how he crosses over all the path of light and the path of darkness of leaving the body. The path of light takes one to the Brahma Jyoti, the path of darkness takes one to the heavenly planets and back to the earthly planets. So he's saying that the devotee surpasses that. So in this chapter then he'll describe how to become such a devotee, or what that means. So this whole chapter is basically discussing devotional service. So first Krishna will describe just what is qualifications in this service. Verse 1. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization, knowing which you shall be relieved of the miseries of material existence. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed." So this verse here then makes three main points. One is that one becomes advanced by hearing about Krishna. Right? Is that here he's saying this? "I shall impart to you this confidential knowledge." Then he'll be relieved from all these miseries because of that. And what is his qualification? He is non-envious. So this is essential point here. Is that, see, when one gets very confidential, then there has to be a lack of envy. One can have acquaintances, one can even have friends who don't have full, the confidentiality isn't that great. You can do so many things with them. Like it's not, especially in the Western scenario, it's not uncommon when you have three friends together that when one of them leaves the room, the other two will talk about the one who left the room, right? And then when he comes back and then someone else leaves, then those two will talk about the one that left. So each one will talk about the other and say, that. But they're friends anyway. They have a good time together and so on. They can do many things together. But it's not necessarily very confidential like that. And they say things and reveal the mind, but it's not that confidential. So there has to be a total lack of envy. Then one can become more confidential or most confidential. So this is the most confidential knowledge. So because Arjuna is non-envious, therefore he can be given this knowledge. Otherwise, then it won't function. You can't receive this knowledge and understand it, realize it, if one is envious. Right? As we described before, envy comes from thinking that why Krishna should be the enjoyer, why we should not also be the enjoyer. So then that means we don't accept his position as the ultimate enjoyer, the Vishayi, and we don't accept ourselves as the servant of the Ashram. Then, if that's not there, well, the knowledge cannot be very confidential. You just will not appreciate. Right? So the whole point is in devotional service, in preaching, is that you go up to the level that someone can appreciate. When you cross beyond it, you create more doubts. Right? Like you're explaining something to somebody, and they understand. They understand and they're now enthusiastic, ready to work. Now you've maybe explained one way or two ways to them, and then now they've understood. Now, if we're, the proper thing is leave it at that. Because the point of your speaking is that they will become encouraged. And that is proper preaching. Now, of course, maybe you can give another three or four illuminations on the point, but if you do, you may create doubt. Because it may be too much for someone to deal with. Too fine, or different, or another angle. And because they have their particular nature, they're going to appreciate the point that you made. Now, if you think, yes, I have more things, or they like that so much, just see what I give them more, then you find you may be bewildered. And then you have to spend a lot more time to bring it back to the original points. So the Krishna is explaining this because Arjuna is not envious. If he is envious or partially envious, he won't explain up to this point. He will have stopped previously. But this point now is because he's not envious. So he's explaining the most confidential knowledge. So he says, this is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. Yeah. And it says, it's everlasting and joyfully performed. The point is brought out is because bhakti is you're always engaging, always doing something nice in the Lord's service. It's always joyful. While this dry renunciation of the jnanis and that, the yogis, is not so joyful. Right? It's not a great joy to sit there and stop the breathing and not move and sit in one place and not become disturbed if ants come and crawl all over you and things like that. It's not great joy. Right? The result at the end, when they see the Lord, that's quite nice. They become peaceful, but it's not joyful. Right? Joyful is actually ananda. Well, peace is just relief from the material pains, relief from material desire. So then, and then pure devotional service is beyond the modes of nature and transcends liberation. So it's called avyayam, which means that can never be destroyed. This will come out later at the end of the verse. It's a very important point. Is that devotional service, unless oneself by creating mad elephant offense, it's never lost. It cannot be destroyed. Like, just as devotional service by performing the material activities with the proper consciousness, one becomes freed from all sin and becomes purified. So this shows that this activity of offering the fruits to Krishna, doing without attachment, is more powerful than the modes of nature. Right? So there's no question that the modes of nature can overpower devotional service. Devotional service, contrary, it overpowers the material nature. So it cannot be destroyed, avyayam, because all there's the eternal, the spiritual realm, and there's the material world, which is temporary. So if the material world cannot overpower it, then what is going to overpower it? So it's avyayam, it's eternal. Then Baladev Vidyabhushan is a very interesting point here. He takes, because we always say the king of knowledge, you know, the secret of secrets, and he puts it the other way. He says the knowledge of king, the secrets of kings. He makes the point, the knowledge, or more exactly, the meditational worship of those who, like kings, have magnanimous, compassionate hearts. They are unlike the crippled-hearted karmis who worship demigods with a desire to obtain sons and other material benefits. Kings, even when they fail to hide their treasures of gems and other valuables, keep their private counsel very hidden. In the same way, even when my devotees do not conceal other thick kinds of knowledge, they keep this knowledge concealed. So unless someone is very proper, one doesn't say too much. That's the meaning of do not preach to the faithless. Right? Is you don't say more than what someone's faith can handle. You go beyond that, then they start to have difficulties. This doesn't... Yeah. The word pavitram... Yeah, okay. means that it purifies all the four stages of sinful reactions. Srila Prabhupada quotes from the Padma Purana that all the four stages means the prarabdha, means what is already fructified, what you're already now receiving the results of, that is destroyed. Though previously Krishna mentioned, I think that it's that something is kept. But the other three are completely destroyed. And this, just to keep us in line, is something is there. Then, phalan mukha means it's just around ready to give the fruits, like a bud. The bud is ready to bloom. It's there, it's complete. Everything's been arranged, lined up. You know, you're walking from here to that building. Already the devotee in the morning swept the road. When he swept the road, he swept the rock off the grass onto the road. Already the other devotees walked by and kicked the rock. It's perfectly pointing up, so its sharp edge is there. You are just walking there, and something else is just happening, or the bird just makes the sound so that you don't notice the rock, and then you step on it and cut your foot. So that's a full-on mukha. It's already ready. And then when you step on the rock, that's the prarabdha. It's already arranged. It's there. It's just waiting for you. Like that. So it's just there. Then, less than that is the kuta, which means like the seed. And then there's the bij. The bij is the desire. You want something. Then, that starts to, that's the desire. Then, when that's cultivated, then the sprout comes. That's the kuta. Then that grows until it arranges the situation for you. And when the situation is nicely arranged, then you're invited to enjoy the results. So all these stages then are removed by devotional service. Therefore it's called pavitram. So it's the best. It's eternal. It removes all the material consciousness. It's kept confidential unless someone is able to accept it. Yeah, then Baladeva Vidyabhushan makes a point. Because this dharma, bhakti yoga, is so joyfully performed, one may wonder who would remain in samsara. So Krishna's next verse then deals with that. Those who are, text 3, those who are not faithful in this devotional service cannot attain me, O conqueror of enemies. Therefore they return to the path of birth and death in this material world. So those who are faithless, they cannot attain Krishna. They hear about devotional service, but they don't take it up. They just don't accept that this leaving karma and jnana and yoga is actually, and taking up bhakti is actually going to get a result. It just sounds too easy and too simple. We generally think something more complicated, more sophisticated, more difficult is going to get us a better result. But something so simple, so sublime is not. So those without faith, they can't. They can't take it up. They just won't accept it. They hear about it, but they don't accept it. So now Krishna then goes on to explain about himself and about this his relationship with the material world. Text 4. By me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not part of this cosmic manifestation. For myself is the source, very source of creation. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me. So Krishna has pointed out that he is maintaining everything. Everything is in him. He is the support of everything. But at the same time, it's not. He's making this point here. This is Chintabheda. He says, all beings are in me, but I am not in them. Then he says, and yet everything that is created does not exist in me. So then Krishna makes this point. He gives the analogy of the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests in the sky, so all created beings rest in him. So the point is brought out that you have, let's say, sky means space. So we have a space, and in that the wind is blowing and moving as it pleases. But it's limited by that space. It can't go out of that space. So in the same way, the living entities, they are moving throughout the universe, but they're limited by this universe. Krishna's given them that much space, and that's it. So they can't go more than that. At the same time as the sky has nothing to do with the air. It just controls it. But it doesn't have any... And so the Krishna just gives that freedom, and the living entities take that freedom and use it as they please. So in this way, we can understand. So then, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur raises a question that his point is that he's given this analogy here to make the inconceivable conceivable. So then the inconceivable's not so inconceivable here. So then he points out that this is Krishna's potency, this is his mystic power, that he can explain his inconceivable nature. So there's a chinta beta beta tattva, basically, because he's saying this, one must have faith. Because otherwise one cannot explain how two things can be happening at once. This is basically what is starting to happen here. Without that faith, then one can't understand. In other words, especially the Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy takes very, very fine faith to be able to accept all the different things that go on. We discussed this before. The other Vaishnava philosophies, much more clear, just one point. You only have to focus on one. But here you have to focus on two at once. So it makes it more fine. It's because Krishna is like that, one can do it. But one has to have that faith. So it's not just logic. One has to have the understanding of God's position. So the answer here is given. The sky is not attached to the wind, which is contained within it, because the sky and wind are unconscious matter, and matter does not form attachments. However, only in one case does living spirit remain non-attached while living in this world and controlling it, and that is in the case of the Supreme Controller. In this way, the inconceivability of the Supreme Controller's being non-attached is established. The example of the non-attached sky is nonetheless offered in order to give ordinary people an opportunity to begin to understand this subject. See, it's like the living entity by nature becomes attached. That's the meaning of the living entity. The living entity, the jiva, is attached. It's just the way it is. Shakti is attached. So we have three options. Well, basically two options. You're attached to Krishna, or you're attached to Maya, right? And within Maya, we can be more attached to the emotional exchanges, or we can be more attached to the senses. Like this. This is our options, but we will be attached. The jiva, there's no question he cannot be attached. That's why he cannot stay in the Brahman. Because in the Brahman, there's no opportunity for attachment. And attachment is ananda. This exchange. So Krishna is unique of all the living entities. He's the only one that can deal with something and not get attached. We will get attached immediately. Right? We do something. We go to a place, some situation, anything. We find some part, something, it's, you know, okay. Like we come into the temple, we find a place to stand. We'll go there the next day and stand there. Right? We won't think of anything of it. We'll just come into the temple every day and standing in that place. We won't think, someone says, you're attached. We'll say, no. Until that day you come in and find someone else standing in that place. And then you think, you know, why are they standing? That's my spot. You know? Then you, because that's just the way the living entity is. They become attached to anything. As soon as they deal with it, they become attached. Right? So in the Vedic culture, the whole idea is this, I mean, in the external form of it, one who has less things to deal with has less opportunities to get attached. That is there. That is why the Vanaprastha Sannyas will be in the Brahmachari, I mean, the vanprastha sannyas will be given respect because they have less things they're dealing with to get attached to. Now the grihastha has more things to deal with and thus get attached to. Because whatever you deal with, one will get attached to. But that kind of detachment is not the goal of the Vedic culture, as Krishna points out. Otherwise he would have said jnana is better than the karma. But he's pointing out as being non-attached to the result, that's the actual thing. So this is the point. Krishna's pointing out here his nature. He's dealing with material nature, but he's not attached. Right? But he's not attached yet. So the living entity is asked, you do the same thing. Right? You work with material nature and not be attached. And now by the definition we've given, the living entity must be attached to something. Therefore, we should transfer attachment to Krishna. Do our duties without material attachment, but be attached to Krishna. That will give us the result. Then we have the same nature as Krishna. Therefore, Krishna says, the jnani is like my very self. He's the same as me. Right? I deal with material nature, I'm not attached. He deals with material nature, he's not attached. So we're the same. Right? This brings out that meaning, is that we're of the same nature. Right? Like the drop of water in the ocean, or the gold ring in the gold mine. Just here in activities, Satchitananda, that's there the same. But here also in activities is the same. Right? But now in this chapter, he's going beyond that point. He's made that point in the last chapter. In this chapter, now he's going to the point of, but one who's attached to me, then he's the most dear. That is special. And Krishna, as you'll point out here, he is attached to them. Right? It's attached to that relationship, that exchange. Prabhupada also points out in this section here that even though he's not, even though Krishna says that he's not the doer, the material nature is doing everything, Prabhupada points out that still not a blade of grass moves without his sanction. He is the ultimate cause of all causes. That must remain. That must be understood. Then in this next part, then Krishna explains how he is creating and destroying this material world. Text 7. O son of Kunti, at the end of the millennium, all material manifestations enter into my nature, and at the beginning of another millennium, by my potency, I create them again. The whole cosmic order is under me. Under my will, it is automatically manifested again and again, and under my will, it is annihilated at the end. So we can, it's by Krishna's desire that it's going on. See, material nature has been empowered. Right? See, those who are into New Age would very much appreciate this quality of Krishna because he's empowered the material nature. He's not a bottleneck or totally controlling and all that, but he gives that freedom to those under him that he delegates this power and empowers them to do the work. Isn't that the way they talk? So Krishna's done this with the material nature, you know. So, like this. In other words, living entities are trying to become God by saying that I empower you to do the thing, and like this, or you know. So Krishna's empowered. So she's independent. She works separate. It means under his direction, he's given the order, the order, what to do. She carries it out, and she has the potency to do that. But that is, she has the potency to take the material elements and move them around. That includes the gross and subtle body. She does not have the power to deal with the devotional activity. The devotional activity is more powerful than her. Therefore, all the reactions and everything are purified by devotional service. So she's empowered, but only as far as moving the material nature. Not more. She can move the elements. That's it. But we see, Krishna describes here and in other chapters, that's because he's empowered, he's entered. But because he's aloof and detached, she moves everything around, but according to his direction. Though he is the power in it. Then Krishna continues, "All this, O Dhananjaya, all this work cannot bind me. I am ever detached from all these material activities, seated as though neutral." Then Krishna explains how he's neutral here, in 10. "This material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O son of Kunti, producing all moving and non-moving beings. Under its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again." So here he uses the word mayadhyakshena. So Vurijan Prabhu breaks this down that maya means by my. Adhi means from above, and aksha means eyes. So it means under my eyes, under his direction. Krishna is watching this. So he's not attached. So under the eyes just means just seeing. So he's not involved. He's just watching. And then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives a point here to explain Krishna's words. "The governmental business of a king, like Ambarish Maharaj, is carried out by his ministers, Prakritis, while the uninvolved king merely remains present. At the same time, unless the king is present on his throne, the ministers are incapable of doing anything. In the same way, unless I give my support as the supervisor, material nature, Prakriti, can do nothing." And then Prabhupada gives a very nice point here, given from the Smriti. Example is given from the Smriti. He says, "Because he glances over material nature, there's undoubtedly activity on the part of the Supreme Lord. But he has nothing to do with the manifestation of the material world directly." This example is given in the Smriti. "When there is a fragrant flower before someone, the fragrance is touched by the smelling power of the person. Yet the smelling and the flower are detached from one another. There is a similar connection between the material world and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Actually has nothing to do with the material world, but he creates by his glance and ordains. In summary, material nature without the superintendence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead cannot do anything. Yet the Supreme Personality is detached from all material elements, activities, excuse me." So it's like we have a flower in ourselves, and then by power of smell, so the smelling is going on, it's an activity, but the flower and the person are not connected. So he glances at the material nature, and he ordains that this is what will happen, but the material nature carries it out. As we see in the Bhagavatam, then, what was that, 8? You brought out that, 8:24, do you remember? And what was the verse, 8:24? I don't remember. 7 or 8. So, there, then it's described that Krishna, that glance is Sadashiva, is Shiva. It's that principle of Shiva, because he touches the material nature. Then Krishna does everything in the material world through him. All the movement of the material nature is done through Shiva. Like that. So he's not dealing. Then the question that you raised is, then if Krishna he has such a wonderful personality, why some people don't respect him? And Krishna makes the point in verse 11. "Fools deride me when I descend in human form. They do not know my transcendental nature as the supreme lord of all that be. Those who are thus bewildered are attracted by demoniac and atheistic views. In that deluded condition, their hopes for liberation, the fruit of activities, and the culture of knowledge are all defeated." So there's many who do not accept this human form. We discussed that before slightly. There are some who just, there can be no form. Anything that's form can't be spiritual. Then there's those who accept that there's a spiritual form, Vishnu, but when he incarnates here as Rama and Krishna, that's just the transformation of the mode of goodness. It's not actually spiritual. So these kind of people cannot understand. Prabhupada makes the point how devotees accept the Lord's form. He says, although the foolish cannot imagine how Krishna, who appears just like a human being, can control the infinite and the finite, those who are pure devotees accept this, for they know that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, they completely surrender unto Him and engage in Krishna consciousness, devotional service to the Lord. So, it's interesting to note here that there's two kinds of bewildered persons here. It mentions the demoniac, by demoniac and atheistic views. So atheistic views, that is the daitya mentality. And the demoniac, that is the danava mentality. So we always hear of the daityas and the danavas. So this is the difference. One is atheistic and the other is demoniac. So they're both demoniac, but just one is a little bit more sophisticated. The atheistic appears to be very civilized, cultured, educated, but he's not. That's the danava, that's the atheistic. And then those who are demoniac, then that is, you know, they're just more rough and gross and, you know, just down-home, sinful people. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that if one is practicing Ashtanga Yoga for liberation, or if one is practicing Karmakanda rituals for material well-being, or if one is practicing Jnana Yoga for knowledge and Brahman realization, all his aspirations will be crushed if he misunderstands Krishna's form to be material. No success is awarded to those refusing to accept Krishna's transcendental form. So, so one gets the success when one understands Krishna to some degree, at least accepts to some degree. One may not be interested. One may also wonder how it is possible that one could know the Lord but not surrender, you know, and still take up these other paths of karma, jnana, or yoga. We see in the Krishna book, then there's the chapter on, I think it's called Ill-Motivated Dhritarashtra. Very short chapter, about 3 pages. In this chapter, Dhritarashtra himself is explaining how Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, absolute controller of everything, you know. He understands, here is God. He is not in that way at all uninformed. But, despite this, he still has his material desires. He wants to see his son on the throne due to his attachments. So even though he knows his God, he's so attached. So like this, is that you want something, still you have to accept Krishna's position. Still have to accept his position. But here, the problem came is, one then would may ask then, why is it that there was a problem here? He's accepting him as the Supreme Lord, but he has his material desire. Because they oppose the Pandavas. And the Lord does not make much distinction between himself and his devotees. So because they accepted, he accepted Krishna, but not his devotees, therefore he was unsuccessful. Then Krishna continues here. Then these are the persons, now he's explained his glories, his position as unattached though controlling material nature and all living entities. Then he shows the foolish people what they do. They don't accept, so they're unsuccessful. Then he tells about the great persons, the Mahatmas. O son of Prita, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible. Always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me, these great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. So So Srila Prabhupada explains here, Mahatma does not divert his attention to anything outside Krishna, because he knows perfectly well that Krishna is the original Supreme Person, the cause of all causes. There is no doubt about it. Such a Mahatma, or great soul, develops through association with other Mahatmas, pure devotees. Pure devotees are not even attracted by Krishna's other features, such as the four-armed Mahavishnu. They are simply attracted by the two-armed form of Krishna. And then Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur mentions, a Mahatma always serves and glorifies Krishna, regardless of time and place. He offers his obeisances and chants a fixed number of rounds with great determination. The word mam is used twice in this verse. The repetition emphasizes that those activities are offered to Krishna and to no one else. In other words, his chanting, his endeavoring with determination, bowing down, this is only to Krishna, no one else. This is making it very clear. Then he goes on to explain, other aspects. Now this is the top. So now he's also explaining others who are worshipping the Lord, but are on a lower level here. 15. Others who engage in sacrifice by the cultivation of knowledge, worship the Supreme Lord as the one without a second, as diverse in many, and in the universal form. Srila Prabhupada points out three levels of worshippers of the Lord. The top, what we just mentioned in the previous verse, is the Mahatmas. The second is the Sukritinas, that's mentioned before, the pious persons, the inquisitive, the one desiring wealth, one desiring freedom from anxieties, and the Jnani. So these are persons who are on various levels of attaining perfection, basically within the realm of sadhana bhakti. And then the Mahatmas, who are on the topmost platform. And then below that, then there is three kinds of jnanis who deal with the absolute truth. Okay, and then this is what is in the verse. So these three then are: one who worships himself as one with the Supreme Lord. Two, he who concocts some form of the Supreme Lord and worships that. And three, he who accepts the universal form, the Virat Roop of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and worships that. Out of the above three, the lowest, those who worship themselves as the Supreme Lord, thinking themselves to be monists, are the most predominant. The second class includes the worshippers of the demigods, those who by imagination consider any form to be the form of the Supreme Lord. And the third class includes those who cannot conceive of anything beyond the manifestation of this material universe. They consider the universe to be the supreme organism, or entity, and worship that. The universal form is also a form of the Lord. So these are the levels. So we can see the one who worships himself he is worshiping the Lord, but he doesn't get very far, because he doesn't accept the Lord's form as transcendental, and therefore, he has these atheistic views. So he doesn't get very far. So whatever they're actually endeavoring for, they never actually get. Therefore, the Mayavadis, they never get to the Brahman. They never get to where they want to go, because they reject the form of the Lord as being transcendental. Though they are worshipping the Lord indirectly. Then better than that is the one who worships the demigods, but takes the demigod as all in all. This isn't he's worshipping just Karmakanda trying to get something there. But he's thinking that this demigod is God. Or, you know, sometimes nowadays they think the child is God, or the mother's God, or father's God, somebody is, you know, anybody's. Matri Devo Bhava, Pitri Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, Atiti Devo Bhava. So they take that meaning they're God. Right? So this is concocted. Like that, but it's better than thinking that I am God, right? You come to the lecture, you sit down and offer your respects to yourself in the form of the audience that's there to hear you speak. You know, so that kind of personality is considered on the totem pole to be on the bottom. And those who worship the totem pole, they're actually considered better than that. You know, they make up their own form, you know. So the best of those who make up their own form are those who understand the demigods. And then those who worship something else, then that's make up their own form, then that's, you know, idol worship. That's the bottom end of that. But it's still considered better than thinking you're God. Then we have the finalist where we understand the universe as God. So one is you understand the universal form, worship that, or the bottom end of that is that you just, the material world, the universe, you accept that as God, the material nature, like that. So these different levels are there. But we Krishna's only recommending the first two. The goal of coming to the platform of the Mahatmas and you going through the process of the Sukritinas. In other words, Sakam Karma Yoga means you have your desires, the interest in relief from anxiety, wealth, or some knowledge, but one goes to Krishna for that. And he performs those activities, but tries to give the fruit to Krishna, how much he can. Then better than that is the jnani who understands that Krishna's position and his position and wants to serve. So he performs karma, but the emphasis is more on the jnana. So this is nishkam karma. So he's working for Krishna. He's given up the fruit already. Sakam means it's my fruit. I give it to Krishna. Nishkam means it's Krishna's fruit before. In other words, the difference is one surrenders before, one surrenders after. Right? I work, I get it, then I'm pious, I surrender it. The other is before I work, I've already surrendered it. That. This point is there. So then, that is the second stage. Going through that progression, then we come to the platform of Mahatmana. Then Mahatma. So this progression is there. So then, now Krishna then explains about the best of those, or the worshipper of the, how you say, the universal form. So how they can see Krishna, how he's entered everything and everywhere. So the next few verses explain that. 16. But it is I who am the ritual, I the sacrifice, the offering to the ancestors, the healing herb, the transcendental chant. I am the butter and the fire and the offering. I am the father of this universe, the mother, the support and the grandsire. I am the object of knowledge, the purifier and the syllable Om. I am also the Rig, the Sama and the Yajurvedas. I am the goal, the sustainer, the master, the witness, the abode, the refuge, and the most dear friend. I am the creation and the annihilation and the basis of everything, the resting place and the eternal seed. O Arjuna, I give heat and I withhold and send forth the rain. I am immortality and I am also death personified. Both spirit and matter are on me. So then this describes how Prabhupada summarizes this here. Since Krishna is both matter and spirit, the gigantic universal form comprising of all material manifestations is also Krishna. And his pastimes in Vrindavan, his two-handed Shyamasundara playing on the flute, are also those of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, in other words, the first two categories are more interested in worshipping Shyamasundara, though they understand how Krishna has entered the material nature, the universal form. But the persons on the third level, then this is how they're going to see God. They see God in basically in the essence of everything. Whatever works, whatever actually gets something done, that's Krishna. You know, so when someone is a pragmatist and they just want, you know, the essence and what really works, they're just somehow or another bewildered by that aspect that Krishna has entered and he's the one that makes it work, though they think they are doing it. By my intelligence, I'm figuring it out. By my endeavors, I am doing it. They don't understand that that's actually Krishna that is there. So the point is, the worshipper of the universal form doesn't think he is understood and he is, therefore, the personification of practicality. But the worshipper of the universal form understands that Krishna is the essence. He's entered everything and he is making everything happen. Like that. Then he describes the the next level down from that is the those who worship the demigods. This is verse 20. Those who study the Vedas and drink the Soma juice, seeking the heavenly planets, worship me indirectly. Purified of sinful reactions, they take birth on the pious heavenly planet of Indra, where they enjoy godly delights. When they have thus enjoyed vast heavenly sense pleasure, and the results of their pious activities are exhausted, they return to this mortal planet again. Thus, for those who seek sense enjoyment by adhering to the principles of the three Vedas, achieve only repeated birth and death. So, now, yeah, I mean, that's pretty self-explanatory. It's that, the point here is that by worshipping the demigods, performing this sacrifice, they are purified of the lower modes, because the demigods are situated in, they live a lifestyle basically of goodness, though they have material desires. They have, you know, the passion is there. But the passion is within the realm of enjoyments within that are flavored by goodness. You know, very fine, clean, not gross, like that. The music is fine, the food is fine, the dress is fine, their activities are fine, like that. So one becomes purified by this, means of the lower modes, the rougher things. Then they go to the heavenly planets. But we see after the heavenly planets, then they come back to here. So they're back to square one. They take birth then in these aristocratic families and all this. But if they haven't done devotional service, then there's a good chance that they're going to misuse this and go against devotional service. They're going to become absorbed and become sinful, or they become overwhelmed by their positions and their wealth. And then, even if they come in contact with devotional service, then, like the point Krishna makes before, the faithless, they cannot take it up. They cannot take up this devotional service. So they become like that. And when they've had the opportunity, then they become, it says, those who are not faithful in this devotional service cannot attain me, O conqueror of enemies. Therefore they return to the path of birth and death in this material world. But given the opportunity, it means those who are not faithful in this devotional service, that means choice is there. They've come in contact with it. They've read Gita, they hear about it. Somehow or another they come in contact, but they reject it. Then they become Naradhama. Then they become lowest of the low. Like this. Okay, then here. Then Krishna here, now all this has gone on. Now Krishna will discuss again his devotees. And how he maintains them and how he takes care of them. Verse 22. But those who always worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack and I preserve what they have. So here Bhurijandra points out, Paryupasate means properly worship, and Nitya, Nityabhiyuktanam, always fixed in devotion. It means one is always worshipping. So this is also your question there, is that they're performing proper worship and they're fixed in this devotion. So it's actually possible to, by practice and determination, come to this platform where one can do one's service and always remember Krishna. Then Srila Prabhupada writes, one who is unable to live for a moment without Krishna consciousness cannot but think of Krishna 24 hours a day. Being engaged in devotional service by hearing, chanting, remembering, offering prayers, worshipping, serving the lotus feet of the Lord, rendering other services, cultivating friendship, and surrendering fully to the Lord. It was also interesting here is that serving the lotus feet of the Lord and rendering other services, how they divide padasevanam and dasyam. So padasevanam means worshipping the Lord's lotus feet, and dasyam means other services other than that. And worshipping the Lord's lotus feet means worshipping his devotees and his paraphernalia. So the worship of the, you know, worship of the devotees, worship of Tulsi, the holy dham, like that, that is padasevana. And then other services than that, then that's dasya. That was an interesting explanation. So then such a devotee, he'll be very determined and very absorbed in his devotional activities to the point where they may neglect themselves. But Krishna says he'll take care of that. He'll carry what they have, and I mean preserve what they have, carry what they lack. He will do this. Yeah. Then the point comes up here. Burjan makes the point here that this is in contrast to what we were reading before about the yogi going to the Brahman Jyoti. The demigods take care. Because he left in the light, then whoever's dealing with the first level, they take him, like up to the sun. Sun is in Uttarayana, so he's in the light. He passes at the proper time. Then the sun will take him up to a particular point. And then from there, then Agni takes him to a point, then the Shushumara, then like this, he just keeps going. So different devatas take him up to a particular level and pass him on to the next, till the soul finally gets to the Brahma Jyoti. But here Krishna is saying he personally takes care of this. So then a question may come up is that what kind of devotee would allow Krishna to take care like this? Then the point is being made that he's so powerful that just by exerting his will, things happen. Just by his desire, unlimited universes are manifesting. So if he can do all that and maintain them, surely taking care of an individual devotee, for him is no burden at all. He likes doing it. But the devotee is not, he is absorbed in doing service for Krishna. He's not worried about these things. Right? He just knows whatever he deserves, Krishna will take care. Like the master will always take care of the servant. Parents will always take care of the child. But according to the needs, according to the situation, like that. Child is sick, then mother won't feed him. Like that. Mother, if the child's not sick, he feeds. So like that. So it's just whatever is arranged by the higher authorities is taken care of by Krishna. So there's a nice story that goes with this. That there was a Brahmana named Arjunacharya. And he was writing his commentary on the Gita. So he came across this verse. And the verse says that Vahami means I carry, means personally Krishna is carrying. So he thought, well, this can't be right. Right? So he thought, you know, Krishna wouldn't personally be doing. He'll do it through his energies. He's been saying that in the whole Gita. He's the modes of nature carrying out everything. He's not the doer, living entities not the doer, material energies the doer. So he thought, maybe it's just not. So he scratched out I carry and inserted karomi, which means I have it done. Means Krishna, for his devotee, he makes sure it gets done. Right? But he's not doing it himself. So now this Arjunacharya, he was extremely poor, and after he made the change in his books, then it was time for begging, as he would go out every day. So he took his bowl and went out begging. Then while he was gone, then his wife heard a knock on the door. She went to the door, and there were these two very beautiful boys there. And they had brought a big amount of food. And they were insisting very quickly that she take this food. You know, and they were looking restless and looking around over their shoulders and, you know, looking very disturbed. And she's thinking, such nice, wonderful, beautiful boys and that, and they brought this food. And she wanted to know, what is this food? And she says that her husband had told them to bring it there. And, you know, and they were afraid of displeasing him, and they wanted to leave quickly before he came. She says, why? Because, you know, because he beat me, you know, he beat us like that. So then, you know, she thought my husband wouldn't do that. Why would he beat them? And then so there, of the two boys, the dark boy, he said, no, he didn't see, and he turned around and showed the marks on his back, and there were these lines like that. And then immediately after she took everything, then they ran off. So then she thought, okay, he sent this and all that, so he must have already arranged everything. So she cooked and she started eating and everything like that. Then the husband came home later and he saw his wife was eating, so he thought this is very strange because she's never done this before. You know, in the Vedic custom, the wife will arrange things, feed the husband, afterwards she'll eat. So how is it she's eating before? And that, then she said, and she just immediately says, why you've been so cruel and acted so improperly? And he said, what did I do? He says, you're beating these two boys, you know, they've sent this, you know, they brought this nice food and everything for you, and you're beating them and all that. He said, beating? What boys? What food? He says, no, they came here and brought this food, said that you sent it here, and you beat them and all that. And so then he said, what boys? Explain what they look like. So she started to explain, you know, and then after, you know, hearing what they looked like and how they were dressed, and one was black and one was white and all that, and then he understood what it was, is that when he had scratched on the book, and that had come on Krishna's back. And then he understood that Krishna actually has, when he says he will take care, it means he'll take care. He personally will take care. And then he was mentioning how his wife was so fortunate because she got the darshan of the boys. Because he didn't have that full faith, he happened to be out begging. Right? But because she didn't, then she got the darshan of them. Like that. Yeah, so he felt that because he had scratched out those words, then Krishna himself personally had to come and show, no, I say, I will do it myself, means I will do it myself. Okay. And then the next point would come up is that, okay, so now in the previous verses, then Krishna said that there's all these worshippers of him. You know, though it's indirect, but they're worshipping him, so naturally it would appear they would get the same result. Maybe a little bit more, take a little more time, a little more convoluted, but they'll get the same result. So then Krishna points out here, 23. Those who are devotees of other gods and who worship them with faith actually worship only me, O son of Kunti. But they do so in a wrong way. I am the enjoyer and master of all sacrifices. Therefore, those who do not recognize my true transcendental nature fall down. So even though they are worshipping indirectly the Lord, because it's not done properly, because they don't understand the Lord's position, they'll fall down. It means they'll go to the heavenly planets, but they'll come back, they'll become absorbed in material activities again. So they're lasting as pious persons doing their worship of the demigods won't remain. Yeah. Prabhupada says here that they demigod worshippers, after great endeavor to follow the Vedas, simply fall down to material existence and do not achieve the desired goal of life. Then he mentions where now, after that, where everybody goes. There's a question, well, okay, then who goes where? You've mentioned so many kinds of worshippers, who goes where? So Krishna makes this point. Those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship ghosts and spirit will take birth among such beings. And those who worship me will live with me. So those who worship Krishna, who develop these qualities that Krishna is desiring, which are the same qualities he manifests. We see when Krishna comes to the material world, he acts in a certain way. Right? And if we want to be close with Krishna, it's natural. We will act in the same way. He comes, he performs his prescribed duties, he's unattached to them. So we perform our prescribed duties, we're unattached. Then we become of the same nature. So then one goes to Krishna. But if not, then one worships demigods, one will go to the demigods. One worships the ghosts, one will go there. Like that. One worships ancestors, he goes to the ancestors. So one should understand this, especially when we get into, demigods we understand, but we have to be careful. When we worship them, unless we're understanding that they are the servants of the Lord, they are representing a particular potency of the Lord, and you're worshipping that potency of the Lord manifest in this demigod, one will go to that demigod. Or nowadays, it's not you know, uncommon. People like to dabble in the, you know, the subtle sciences of the subtle bodies, the ghosts, and all this kind of stuff. But by dealing with one, one goes to them. That is just, that is the deal. That's the point. You worship the demigod, they're pleased, they bring you to them. You deal nicely with the ghosts and all that, they're pleased, they bring you to them. Right? In other words, it doesn't go necessarily the way we think it should go. It goes the way what the relationship's established. You cannot deal with the ghosts or the ancestors and think that you're going to just get away without going to them. You know, especially ghosts, they that's how they work it out. They take care of you for the time being now, but then they get you. They when you leave the body, then they take you, and then you have to live with them. So they've assisted you while you're in your gross body, but then once they you leave the gross body, then you end up assisting them. Right? So it's one has to be very careful. Then Krishna then explains in the devotional process how to worship him now. He said one should worship. All this time he's been saying, one should worship one who worships, one who always thinks of all these things. Now he says here at 26, if one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water, I will accept it. Interesting, yeah. Means we see in the other processes, it's very great endeavor. The demigods, you have to have so much wealth, very properly trained Brahmins, you know, so much time, the proper times and everything, to do it very elaborate. And the demigods are then pleased with what you've offered. Then with that you get your result. This is great endeavor. You know? And if you deal with the others, ancestors, ghosts, then you're dealing in some pretty strange situations. You know, very strange times of the night, you know, on strange days, like that. And so it's, the endeavor is there. Great endeavor is there. Either in a lot of ingredients and nice situations, or not so many ingredients and very not so nice situations. But here Krishna is just saying, you just give this fruit, flower, leaf, or water. And it's interesting point is that all of them are said in singular. It's not that he's connected this. You offer me all these four. He's saying you can offer all four or three or two, at least one, right? Like, or water. You don't have anything else, at least you can give some water to Krishna. That much you can do. Generally, water is available, at least most places. Water is available. So he's only asking for that because it's only a medium through which to express one's affection for Krishna, one's devotion. So that's what he's interested in. So he uses the word bhakti twice in this verse, just to point out that that's what he's interested in. So then it's pointed out that all these things here one is doing, it's not that just one does that, but one's whole life is dedicated to just giving it to Krishna. There's all these things you must render the service to bring these things. Grow the flowers, grow the vegetables, do all the different things, arrange all these things. So all that making nice arrangements for Krishna becomes one's life. So that's pointed out here. So now, that is the top platform. That's just totally absorbed. Then he gives here another aspect. It means just a step below that, just like before. He'll give the Mahatmanas, Tumam Partha, then he tells about the Sukratinas. Like that, the four who are, in other words, there's the Uttamadhikaris and those within Sadhana Bhakti. So here now, that was the topmost platform. Just you give like that, he's perfectly satisfied. Now he's saying here, if one is on the level of Sadhana, then what to do? Then he says here, whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, and whatever austerities you perform, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering to me. So then this means, we'll see in here, that you have this is karma yoga. Prabhupada mentions this in a lecture here in Mayapur, on the prayers of Queen Kunti in 1974. He says, Krishna is meant for the Paramahamsa and Muni, very, very exalted persons. Yoga means contact or having connection. Bhakti yoga means directly connected with Krishna or God. Other yogas are not directly connected. When there is karma yoga, it is adulterated. It is not pure. Karma yoga means that yat karoshi, yat ashnasi, yaj jahosi, tadasi yat. That's this verse. In the beginning, one cannot take to pure bhakti yoga. Therefore, karma yoga is recommended. People are interested in different types of work. Therefore, Krishna says, yat karoshi, never mind whatever you are doing. So how does it become karma yoga? Now, kurushva tad madarpanam, you give it to me. Krishna says, all right, go on. You are attached to business. You go on doing that. But the money earned out of that, out of your business, you give to me. This is karma yoga. It doesn't matter whatever you are doing, but the ultimate result you give to me. So we can see that there's, we can take this also at the two levels of the karma yoga. Is the sakam and nishkam, where it's you thinking it's yours and you give something, or you give the whole thing, or you think this is Krishna's work. But it's Krishna's work, I have to do it, I have a conditioned nature, I must engage in Krishna's service, so I like to do this work for Krishna. Right? And one does that, but one considers the result Krishna's. So one can understand both of these out of this. So it's just a matter of where the surrender of the fruit comes. The one means we're not detached from the beginning. Right? We're going to do this work, we're not attached to the result from the beginning. The other one, the attachment is there for the result, you get the result, then you give it to Krishna. Like that. So this is the difference between the sakam and the nishkam. Then the results of doing this, Krishna says, 28, in this way you'll be freed from bondage to work and its auspicious and inauspicious results. With your mind fixed on me in this principle of renunciation, you will be liberated and come to me. So by this process, one comes to the liberated process platform. You'll be liberated and come to me. Right? Means when one comes to the Brahma-Bhuta platform, one is liberated. So by following this, one will be liberated. One will come to the Brahma-Bhuta, where one gives up all those attachments and all need for material engagement. Then, because you've always kept Krishna as your goal, then you will go to Krishna. Right? So he's showing those stages. By doing this, then you will come to the platform of this Mahatmanastu Mam Partha, and this Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam. Is that you just be able to worship in pure devotion. That will come by following this process. Here he says, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains, he, the person described in the previous verse, meaning whatever you do, whatever you eat, not only becomes liberated, but also achieves vimukti. He becomes exceptional, vishishta, among those who are liberated and comes to me in order to serve me directly. So not only he becomes mukta, but he becomes vimukta, and he's special. He goes to Krishna. Because Krishna mentions, out of so many liberated persons, only hardly one knows Krishna. So that's very special, the devotee. So by this process of following this nishkam karma, one comes to Krishna. Or if one is already on that platform, then he goes to Krishna. So whether he is on the platform of sadhana or whether he's on the platform of Brahma-Bhuta, in either case, he goes to Krishna. That's the whole point, because he's keeping Krishna as his goal. Baladeva Dibhushan, he explains, the consequence of such devotion is described in the verse beginning, Shubha. That's the one we just read. When you engage in the kind of devotional service characterized by offering all works to me under my order, then you become freed from the bondage of material activities. You not only become mukta, liberated from material activities, but vimukta, and come to me. You become exceptional amongst those who are liberated and come near me in order to serve me directly. And Prabhupada, so now, then the next point is being made is, okay, now Krishna's before said, now I'm maintaining everybody, everything is going on in my direction. I'm creating, I'm maintaining, I'm destroying, I'm unattached, all these things. Then he's just gone on to explain how the atheists, you know, they don't get any good result. Then the demigod worshippers, they do what they're doing, they don't get any good result. And the devotee, he gets a wonderful result. He gets the best result. So then one may say, well, it appears to be a little partial here. Krishna has explained all this. He opens the chapter by saying how, you know, I'm so detached in all this and I'm running everything. And then we find he's now explaining how the devotee gets a good, only the devotee gets a good result, others don't. So then this point is being made. 29. I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone. I am equal to all. But whoever renders service unto me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I am also a friend to him. Okay, so Baladev Vidyabhushan then. Here's the point, is that Krishna is like the rain. Rain is impartial. Rains on the land, rains on the rocks, rains on the water, the ocean. I think it's interesting. Someone told me that they did a study, and I think 80% of the rain goes on water. You know, the ocean and lakes, and it doesn't go on the land. I think only, maybe 60%. Forget it. Some very big amount. Only 20% goes on land that you can actually grow something out of. So the majority, it's going everywhere. But the point is that these now it goes on that land, but then you get different results from that. When the rain comes, it goes there and nourishes all the plants. So some grow sweet fruits and some grow bitter ones. You know, some are very nice and wonderful, fragrant, auspicious, some are inauspicious. So Krishna is taking care of everyone, their needs, what they want. But their own desires create, you know, the directions that they go. Baladev Vidyabhushan mentions here, he explains Krishna's mood in the first half of the verse as the Paramatma. It means, I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone. I am equal to all. So he says, sending forth and maintaining all kinds of beings among the demigods, humans, animals, and non-moving creatures, and so on, I, the Lord of all, am equal. I am just like a cloud pouring rain on all kinds of seeds. Among all these creatures, none are my enemies, and none are especially dear to me. But in the second half, then he confirms his Krishna as Bhagavan, not as Paramatma, as Bhagavan. He is partial to his devotees. So Krishna describes that although the material world rests in him, he remains aloof from it. Here, on the contrary, you find that Krishna does not remain aloof from his devotees. Srila Prabhupada writes, one may question here that if Krishna is equal to everyone and no one is his special friend, then why does he take special interest in the devotees who are always engaged in his transcendental service? But this is not discrimination. It is natural. Any man in this material world may be very charitably disposed, yet he has a special interest in his own children. The Lord claims that every living entity, in whatever form, is his son. So he provides everything with a generous supply of the necessities of life. He's just like a cloud which pours rain all over, regardless of whether it falls on rock or land or water. But for the devotees, he gives specific attention. The very phrase Krishna consciousness suggests that those who are in such consciousness are living transcendentalists, situated in him. The Lord says here distinctly, Maite, they are in me. Naturally, as a result, the Lord is also in them. If a reciprocal relationship is not present between the devotee and the Lord, then there's no personalist philosophy. So because the devotee is in him, he is also in them. So the devotee is always thinking the Lord, so the Lord naturally thinks of the devotee. The karmi doesn't think of the Lord, so the Lord doesn't think of them. He takes care of them. As Paramatma, he takes care. He arranges everything. They're taken care of. Whatever they need, whatever they desire, they get according to what they deserve. But because they don't think of him, he does not think of them. So it's natural. It still goes back to his point before. He's just dealing with the living entity how they want. So it's not that he's unfair. Right? Just they turn to him, he turns to them. The others follow their own methods, you know, or Krishna's the indirect methods of approaching the Lord, and they get an indirect result. So it's how they surrender, Krishna's reciprocating, that's all. Prabhupada then mentions this about this point of, oh, here, this is where it came out. Yeah, he says here that he is not like a kalpa vriksha tree who responds equally to all requests. Rather, he is willing to become the enemy of his devotee's enemy, as Krishna told Duryodhana. Anyone who is envious of the Pandavas is envious of me and is my enemy. Right? So even though no one's his enemy, you become the enemy of his devotee, then he becomes enemy of that person. Like that, because it's personal, it's a personal relationship. So Prabhupada points out how this personal relationship is there. If this is not accepted, then there's no personal philosophy. One can't understand. Then we go back to the atheists who don't understand Krishna's form, can't understand his human dealings, his relationships, and they get destroyed. They don't get any benefit. So Prabhupada points out here, when a diamond is set in a gold ring, it looks very nice. The gold is glorified, and at the same time the diamond is glorified. The Lord and the living entity eternally glitter, and when a living entity becomes inclined to the service of the Supreme Lord, he looks like gold. The Lord is a diamond, and so this combination is very nice. Okay, so now he's explained about his devotees and how he's takes care of them very nicely. So now we come to a very famous verse, is that he always takes care, maintains them, and deals everything with them. Then if the devotee has some difficulty, then what happens? So here he says, even if one commits the most abominable action, if he is engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered saintly because he is properly situated in his determination. He quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. O son of Kunti, declare it boldly that my devotee never perishes. So then a few points come up here. So that the devotee, even though something has gone wrong in his devotional service, he's determined to continue serving Krishna. So Prabhupada says here, the word sadur eva, he is saintly, are very much emphatic. They are a warning to the non-devotees that because of an accidental fall down, a devotee should not be derided. He should still be considered saintly, even if he has accidentally fallen down. And the word mantavya is still more emphatic. If one does not follow this rule and derides a devotee for his accidental fall down, then one is disobeying the order of the Supreme Lord. The only qualification of a devotee is to be unflinchingly and exclusively engaged in devotional service. On the other hand, one should not misunderstand that a devotee in transcendental devotional service can act in all kinds of abominable ways. This verse only refers to an accident due to the strong power of material connection. So it's very careful. One cannot think that I'm a devotee, I can act any way I like. Otherwise, this is the seventh offense against the holy name. And it's interesting to note, in that seventh offense, it says, Na vidyate tasya yamer hi shuddhi. Means, those who adopt that mentality will never be purified, even if carried to the court of Yamaraj, the superintendent of death. It means, even they go to Yamaraj, and he gives them all the punishments and everything that would normally purify others of their reactions to what they've done wrong, it won't purify this person. Because this person is performing sinful activities on the strength of the holy name. But here we're talking about an accidental fall down. So now this is very clear. The point is being made very strongly, and it'll come out Vishwanath Chakravarti gives very elaborate discussion on this, which we will read here. But the point being made is that if someone falls down, this in no way means they were not advanced. And anyone who says they're not advanced is disobeying the order of the Lord. Because someone fell down, then one may say, oh, they were not a devotee. One may say, maybe they were not on the topmost platform. They were not a Mahatma. They were not on the platform of Prema. But it would be very hard to prove, according to Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, that Bharat Maharaj, one, was not a devotee, and two, that he was not an Uttamadhikari. I personally would challenge anyone to disprove that. Uttamadhikari, right? But he fell down. So, if we want to say that they were not a devotee, we can say, okay, they fell down, they were not on the platform of prema. It means the second stage of Uttamadhikari. So that means from Uttamadhikari on down. So the point is anyone may have an accidental fall down. And Krishna is very emphatically here, Prabhupada says, are very emphatic. Sadhur Eva, he says, are very emphatic. So in English it may not sound so emphatic, but in Sanskrit it is. Therefore Prabhupada in the purport points this out. So anyone who says they were not devotees or criticizes as going against the order of the Lord. If you are in a position to help them, this and that, you may criticize the particular activity or, you know, what may have caused the thing. But just to make a general comment is going against the order of the Lord. And he's made this point very strongly, Krishna. So we must remember that. Because devotees are very special. We just spent up to now so many chapters of the Gita showing how the devotee is so rare and how Krishna takes care. And he says even a little advancement is never lost. He is maintaining the devotees. Personally, he's taking care. So we must understand that nobody gets away from Krishna so easily. Right? Therefore, he says, he quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace, O son of Kunti. Declare it boldly that my devotee never perishes. So, the devotee is not lost. So here he's saying my devotee never perishes. He's talking about the person who's fallen down. So in Krishna's word, he's not calling only someone on the platform of prema, a devotee. He's taking anyone who is endeavoring on this path from sakam, you know, karma yoga to nishkam, up to being absorbed in, you know, up to the Brahma-Bhuta platform. He's accounting all these as devotees. He's not only counting just the person on the platform of pure unalloyed devotion. He's counting from all these levels. So when that's clear, then it also makes it very clear in dealing with devotees, how we deal. One has to be very, very careful in the dealings. One has to be very proper in the etiquette and behavior. Because Prabhupada did such a wonderful thing that made devotional service so readily available, association so readily available, the scriptures so readily available, we may become conditioned by a sense of goodness that everything's just nice. And then we become very intolerant of anything else because we've forgotten. We become so absorbed and surrounded by devotional service that we forget, you know, actually the rarity of it. But if we understand this verse, then it makes it more easy to... It doesn't matter. As long as one is determined to continue, then it goes on. So now I'd like to, even though it's a little lengthy, I would like to read what Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur says. I don't want to paraphrase it because I'll miss it. It's full of very essential and strong points. Before we start, Prabhupada makes the point that there's no need for this devotee to perform ceremonial atonement. A Prayaschitti, as we discussed, I think it was yesterday. He just has to continue in devotional service. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments on both these verses. The previous one means saying that if he commits abominable actions, if he is engaged in devotional service, he is to be considered saintly because he is properly situated in his determination. He quickly becomes righteous and attains lasting peace. O son of Kunti, declare it boldly that my devotee never perishes. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, one might ask, if someone is corrupted by such bad behavior, how can he be a sadhu? This is answered. He should be considered as such and thought of as a sadhu. He should be considered is an injunctive statement, means Krishna says he should be considered. He is to be considered. So Krishna is giving, it's an order that he is to be considered. We may think he is or not, but Krishna orders, you must think he is. If this injunction is disobeyed, there will be unfavorable consequences. Right? Vishwanath points out that if you speak in this way, there will be unfavorable consequences. Right? For the non-devotees, we know well the consequences. For those who are devotees, then we may find that the one's advancement may become reduced or checked. Right? And if one carries too far, then one can commit a mad elephant offense and uproot one's own creeper. Right? Okay. In other words, the evidence for the truth of this is that it is simply my command. Means he's presenting all this as Krishna speaking. In other words, he says the evidence for the truth of this is just Krishna said it. Right? We accept the scripture. Scripture is coming from the Lord. Krishna says this is the way it is. We accept it. That's the evidence. Well, someone might say, one may be considered a sadhu partially to the extent that he is worshipping you, but to the extent that he is usurping other men's wives and property, he is not to be considered a sadhu. This is answered by the word eva only. No, yeah. He should only be considered a sadhu in all ways, completely. In other words, he's saying you don't have any other alternative. You can consider him as a sadhu, or you can also consider him as a sadhu, or if you want, you can consider him as a sadhu, but you only have the option to consider him as a sadhu. There's no other option. It says in all ways, completely. We should never view him not as a sadhu. His determination is completely fixed, and this is what he's thinking. It means the person who has had a fall down. I may go to hell or obtain an animal birth because of my unavoidable sinful reactions, but I will never give up my exclusive worship of Sri Krishna. Such determination is praiseworthy. Right? So if someone is situated like this, he must be accepted and must be given the opportunity to continue service. But otherwise, if we are foolish and think, no, we have to go through some ceremonial prayaschitya, that some external activity is going to purify a sinful desire, then that means we have not understood one word of Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita has been pointing out that material activities, sinful reactions, are destroyed not because of any prayaschitya. There is not one prayaschitya that will destroy all sinful activities. You may get rid of some of the prarabdha, but you don't get rid of the things before it. The seeds is sad. Then this would also be very hard to explain according to Guru Sadhu and Shastra, that the prayaschitti is actually going to do some spiritual benefit. No, the real prayaschitti is continuation of devotional service, because that then removes these sinful desires. That brings one to the topmost platform. So if someone is having problem in devotional service, the solution is more devotional service. Right? Whatever may be fitting. But the point is one is considered a sadhu and one is engaged. And it's glorious if one feels that determination to continue devotional service even though one's had problems. And those who encourage them to go away, then, as is pointed out here in the beginning, if this injunction is disobeyed, there will be unfavorable consequences. So I will not speculate what will happen like that. But the point is this is Krishna's order. And he says, because I've ordered it, you have to accept it. And that's why this chapter is being read. If you don't accept it, don't read this chapter. Because he said, this chapter is only for those who are non-envious. And if you're envious, don't read it. Because Krishna's going to say stuff like this in this chapter. He's going to talk about the topmost platform of devotees over all other existences in the creation. And if you don't like it, you're reading the wrong chapter. And possibly the wrong book. You should just stick to Mahabharata and read about Duryodhana and Karna and all nice Varnashram stuff that has nice fruit of results and nice prayaschitya. You know, Yudhishthira does this Rajasuya sacrifices prayaschitya for killing all the different kings and all these things. If that's how you feel, stick to that. I mean, it's 100,000 verses is plenty to keep you busy. Just avoid these 700. That's all. It's not a big deal. Like that, avoid 700 out of there. And if not, if you can't avoid that, at least avoid these 34 in this chapter. Because it's the most confidential knowledge. You will not appreciate it. Because Krishna is making the point. This is my devotee, this is how I deal with them. You like it? Good. If you don't like it, then I'm sorry. You know, but as God, that's his position. So now he continues. I mean, this has been, okay, a little bit above board. The person's done something wrong, and he is, you know, determined to continue his devotion, even though there's going to be a reaction, and he's considered saint. But now he goes on, Vishwanath. You know, up to here, okay, I can adjust with this. Then he says, but one may ask, why do you accept the worship of such an irreligious person? Why do you consume the food and drink? Why do you consume the food and drink offered by one whose heart is contaminated by lust, anger, and other faults? In response, the Lord says, he quickly becomes religious. This is not expressed as he is going to quickly become, or he will soon achieve peace. Rather, the present tense is used, he becomes and he attains. So Krishna is saying, because he's properly situated, he's attaining now. He's becoming now, not in the future. Okay, when I, because of my attachment to the material nature, accept that, okay, now the guy has been properly purified and everything, now I accept that, okay, now maybe he can be making some advancement. No, Krishna is saying from today it's happening. He uses the present term. He didn't use future tense. Right? And Krishna himself is making the point. I didn't use future tense on purpose. Because right now, from now, he is making advancement. He is rectifying it. He is purifying himself. Then the Lord continues. This means that immediately after he commits impiety, he remembers me and feels remorse. He thus quickly becomes religious. He thinks, alas, alas, there's no person more fallen than me. I defile the reputation of the community of devotees. Says here, damn me. Yeah. Or probably, I am damned. Yes. Again and again, feeling remorse like this, he achieves complete peace and detachment. Right? Peace is attained when one loses desires. So this comes. Peace is there when desires are lost. Right? We're only in a, we have no peace when there's desires, material desires. Material desires go when it's peaceful. So by this remorse, all this is removed. That's very important that it's understood that Krishna's, Vishwanath is explaining both sides of the situation. He's explaining how others should deal with such a person and how they should be very careful. At the same time, he is telling how such a person must think. Because Krishna is saying here, no, because he's thinking like this, everything is going very nicely. Right? So someone like this can't say, hey, Krishna says like this, why are you getting on my case? No. Right? That's not for that person to say. The person who's having the difficulty, he doesn't explain those points. He himself is simply thinking, I must be remorseful. You know, I am degrading myself. I'm ruining the reputation of the Vaishnava community. You know, so I'm feeling very bad. But the others do not deride him. Then he goes on, more points. Well, one may say, if he actually becomes religious, there can be no argument about such a person. But what about a devotee whose behavior is wicked and who fails to give up his bad behavior throughout his whole life? What can be said about him? Now we get real crux. What about the one who's fallen and he's not given it up yet? You know, I can understand, okay, they fell, they made a mistake, they're not doing that mistake now, they're remorseful. Okay, I may willingly or even grudgingly accept this point. Because now he's righteous. Okay, he did some nonsense, but I can accept that he's situated nicely now, he's performing the service, remorseful, all these things, so okay, I can accept. Now Vishwanath said, what about the one who hasn't given up? Not only hasn't given up, his whole life he's like this. Then what happens? What can be said about him? Then, always affectionate to his devotees, the Lord responds to this doubt with complete confidence and with some anger. Right? Because now it's kind of like the point's being pushed too far. You know, you didn't accept it so graciously. And you keep pushing, no, but what about this? So now, because of his affection for the devotees, he responds very strongly and with a little bit of anger. In the words beginning Kaunteya, my devotee never perishes. So this is the point for this. So we can see the verses divided. That my devotee never perishes. Even when he dies, he never falls down. To encourage Arjuna, who is disturbed with sorrow and apprehension over the thought that hard-hearted quibblers who indulge in false logic will not accept this, the Lord says, O Kaunteya, go to the assembly of these disputants and making a loud sound with drum and cymbals, raise your arms fearlessly and declare my promise. I, Krishna, am the Supreme Lord, and even if my devotee is wicked in his behavior, he will never perish. On the contrary, such a devotee is sure to become successful. Their bad logic will be shattered by this confident declaration. They will certainly take shelter of you as their guru. Such is the interpretation given by Sridhar Swami in his commentary. Vishwanath is making this point. Then Vishwanath continues, someone may ask, why doesn't the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself make this promise? Why does he instead deputize Arjuna to promise? In the same way as the Lord will later say, without a doubt, you will come to me. I promise you this because you are very dear to me. Why doesn't he now say, Kaunteya, I promise that my devotee will never perish? Here is the answer. At that moment, the Lord was thinking, I am very affectionate to my devotees and cannot tolerate their being discredited at all. I will often break even my own promise and let myself be discredited to protect my devotee's promise. For example, I will soon fight with Bhishma and discard my own promise in order to protect Bhishma's promise. Thus, atheistic, logical quibblers will only laugh if I now offer my own promise. But they will have to acknowledge Arjuna's promise as if it were written in stone. Therefore, I will have Arjuna make this promise. So that is Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's point. Like that. So, means someone who's fallen and his determination, he's continuing, his service hasn't given up, then it means very quickly he becomes righteous and his lasting peace. Means very quickly means it's going on right now. The process is already going on. And he has the proper attitude. But even if he remains wicked, then Krishna says he will not perish. Because he's a devotee. He's performed service. It will not be lost. Right? He will not fall down. He will not fall out. We even see Bharat Maharaj, he took birth as a deer, but he didn't lose his consciousness. Okay. So Krishna is taking care. He's pointing out here, from his angle, how dear the devotees are to him. And those devotees are always thinking of him. Right? If we don't think of Krishna, oh, he'll take care, don't think. Of course, Krishna will take care. But the reciprocation will not be as strong as one who appreciates what Krishna says here and then deals with that. So Krishna doesn't like to see his devotees discredited. So we must always be careful. That's why the first offense of the holy name is to blaspheme the devotees of the Lord who have dedicated their lives to the preaching. That's the first offense, because Krishna just can't tolerate that. Right? He doesn't even mind himself being discredited, but he doesn't like his devotees. Therefore, he'll break his own promise to keep Bhishma's promise. Right? Bhishma's promise is that he's going to fight so strong to kill Arjuna that unless Krishna gets involved, no one can stop him. That's his vow. Krishna's vow is, I will not fight on this battlefield. So to keep Bhishma's vow, Krishna breaks his. So his devotee is more dear. Then Krishna continues that those glorifying the path of bhakti and those who take shelter of him. 32. O son of Pita, those who take shelter in me, though they be of lower birth, women, vaishyas, merchants, and shudras, workers, can attain the supreme destination. How much more this is so of the righteous brahmanas, the devotees, and the saintly kings. Therefore, having come to this temporary, miserable world, engage in loving service unto me. Engage your mind always in thinking of me. Become my devotee. Offer obeisances to me and worship me. Being completely absorbed in me, surely you will come to me. So Krishna is making the point that whatever we start in devotional service, whatever we do, we take our duties, do them for Krishna without desire for the result, then we will come to this perfectional platform. It doesn't matter where one starts. Whatever position, one will attain to this perfectional platform. Like that. He's saying, yeah. Yeah, say, so therefore, having come to this temporary miserable world, engage in loving service. Doesn't matter your platform. Means you study where your platform is, where you have to engage yourself, and from that point, engage. Perform loving service. Right? Start the process as Krishna has described. But understand that devotion is the goal. Don't think that perfection of my service means a perfection in the externals of my service is the goal. No, it's the devotion of offering that. I have the ability, may have the ability to render very very sophisticated and very wonderful service. But it's the act of doing that for Krishna that Krishna is interested in, not the wonderful service. Right? We can sing, but Gandharvas can sing better. And Krishna's not interested in the Gandharvas singing because there's no devotion. Right? So he's interested that you do it in devotion, whatever it is. It's materially perfect or not. But you're trying your best to do your best for Krishna. So whatever position. Then he gives 4 points here. How to engage. So he says here, Manmana, always think of him. Bhava mad bhakta, become my devotee. Mad yaji, worship me. And mam namaskuru, offer obeisance unto me. So the point is that one is serving, but one should also fix the mind on Krishna. One shouldn't let it wander all over the place. You should try to fix it on Krishna. Otherwise, then you may find you end up with wherever your mind's wandering. Krishna says he provides what you lack, keeps what you have. Then you end up with things that you didn't necessarily want. The mind was thinking that. You're thinking, oh, about this, I need this, or you're standing in front of the deities and you're thinking about some clothes and this and that, and then later in the day, somebody comes along and offers you some clothes, you know, and then you think, yes, you know, I should have been thinking about Krishna. So instead of getting Krishna, I got some clothes, right? Better to get Krishna, right? Krishna is going to give you the clothes anyway. right? You don't think about it. You just think of him. But so one should be very, very careful about this. So trying to fix the mind on what one's doing. Of course, it takes practice. Krishna makes that point. Determination and practice. Then it will be successful. Yeah. Baladeva Vidyabhushan makes a comment here. Krishna says to Arjuna, a so-called devotee of a king, the king's servant, is actually thinking about his own wife and son, and so on. His thoughts are not fixed upon the king, thus he is not actually the king's devotee. You, however, in contrast with such a person, should be absorbed in thinking of me and should be my devotee. Your mind should always be fixed like an uninterrupted flow of honey on me, the son of Vasudeva. You should think of me as your own master and as the very goal of your life. Then Burjan points out that this verse will also be repeated in the 18th chapter. Slight, the last line, slight variation. But the same point of how to engage in devotional services there. He gives many quotes to point out that this verse and the Sarva Dharma Parityaja, these are very essential verses in the Gita. So this is the most confidential of all the verses. Because the 10th chapter is the most confidential chapter, and this is the most confidential verse of the whole chapter. So it's the most confidential verse. So he gives many, many... interesting here, this purport. And this is from Bhagavatam 1.15.51. Oh, this is the lecture on that. And the very simple thing is, Yad idam parama paramam guhyam mag bhaktesh vabhid bhid bhad padyasati. What? This is this confidential service, preaching of Bhagavad Gita. What is that? Bhagavad Gita preaching. The essence is Sarva Dharmam Parityaja Mam Ekam Sharanam Braja. To show this. Simply go and preach this very thing. Krishna says, Manmana Bhavamad Bhakto Madhyajimam Namaskuru. This is Krishna's desire. Preach to the world. Just be Krishna conscious. Manmana. Just become Krishna's devotee. Manmana Bhavamad Bhakto Madhyaji. Just worship Krishna, Namaskuru, just offer your obeisances to Krishna. Four words. Then you become a preacher. It is not very difficult to become a preacher and to become a spiritual master. How? Very simple thing. Go and preach, go and speak what Krishna says. That's all. You just have to know these four words, then you can preach. So Prabhupada's pointing out, is you understand this, is you give up all the varieties of dharma, and the only interest is to serve Krishna, and this is the best way to serve. So this ends the ninth chapter. I didn't say tenth chapter all along. This is the ninth chapter. The ninth chapter. Okay, so are there any questions on this? Or points to be made, or yes.
The Gopimans in another book make similar points about this devotee who endeavor properly is pure devotee. I can't understand this point clearly. If I have some material desire and still I never try, I need to be devoted.
Okay. We understand the point? This is in connection where we've discussed also here a few times. Anyavilasita means that which is in pursuance of unalloyed devotion. That's called pure devotion. So it's just like this. A child picks up something and brings it, or a child does something. A very small child right? Very small children, the coordination is not very good. Now, they do some activity. Now, how do affectionate adults see that activity? Do they see, as a kid, wasn't done so well, he did drop it twice, and can't walk a straight line if you paid him, and it did take him about four times as long as anybody else to do it, and he makes all these funny faces while he does it, and, you know, why can't he just be normal? That's how an affectionate adult will think? No. They'll think, very nice, well done. Why? Because of their broad-mindedness, because of the compassion. So this is the way the Lord and His pure devotees are. If the endeavor is to, for the purpose of pure, unalloyed devotion, though we are not on the platform, it's accepted as pure devotion. Not pure, unalloyed devotion. But pure devotion. Right? It's just like this. You have non-Vedic philosophies, you have Vedic philosophies, right? So I present two points. So one can think that's all there is. Then I say, but within the Vedic, there's two points. There's the Vaishnavs, and there's the Shankarites, the impersonalists. Within, you know, the Shankarite, I mean, within the impersonalists, there's two, the Mayavadis and the Brahmavadis. Within the Vaishnavas, we see four sampradayas, right? Within the Madhva Sampradaya, we see two, those who are followers of Madhva and those who are followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, right? So sometimes the terms become interchangeable. So most of the time you'll see Prabhupada talking about pure devotion or pure devotee. And this can either be meaning the pure devotee means the pure unalloyed devotee, or the pure devotee meaning one who is in pursuance of pure unalloyed devotion. Depending upon the situation, it can mean one or the other, or both. Many times you see Krishna, when he's describing, he uses one verse, he gets many things done with it. Right? The same time when Prabhupada says pure unalloyed devotion, that just means pure unalloyed devotion, it doesn't mean something else, because it's specific. So something more specific takes precedence over something more general. That's the rule. So when we say Vaishnava, it's general. And when we say Gaudiya Vaishnava, then that's specific. Right? It's still within the realm of Vaishnava. But then you can't exchange it. You know, if you're saying the Vaishnavas and the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, then you understand the Vaishnavas means those who are not Gaudiya Vaishnavas, the other sampradayas. But if you're talking about the Gaudiya, the devotees, and then you say, like in Chaitanya Lila, and then you say the Vaishnavs, so what do the Vaishnavs want? It's not that because he didn't say Gaudiya Vaishnav, now it just means it could be anybody. Because all this there are Gaudiya Vaishnavs. Right? So Rupa Goswami makes the point that which is in the pursuance of pure devotion is accepted as pure devotion. Because it's just a matter of time. For us, we're very conditioned by time. And for us, you know, 50 years is a long time. Right? But for Krishna and the Nitya Siddhas, it's nothing. Brahma's lifetime is 3/4 of a second on their time scale. 3/4 of a second. Right? The time it takes to breathe out and breathe in. That's all the longer it is. So within that, 50 years is how much? So what do they care about? To them it's nothing. You know? Because they know if you just persevere, because Krishna says continue he's always encouraging to continue with determination, fix your mind, all that. Otherwise he would have said it once and that's it. But he keeps encouraging, keeps saying. It's not that the parents don't understand or are very satisfied. Yes, the kid is like this, and then when he's, you know, 30 years old, he'll still make all the same funny faces and still walk in the same funny way and still drop things on the ground and still make all the funny noises. You know. No, they know with time they grow up, they mature, and they turn into a very, you know, responsible person in the community. So in the same way, the Krishna and the Acharyas, they understand that whoever's taken up this path is perfect. Right? And if one follows it, one will become perfect. Krishna's saying that again and again and again, verse after verse after verse. And he mentions before, those who have doubt, they don't get anywhere. Because they're neither happy in this life or the next. Right? Because in this life, they can't dedicate themselves purely to the process. At the same time, they can't fully get into that. So they're never happy. Those who doubt. So one should not be doubtful. One should understand this process works. It'll even work on ourselves. Each individual thinks the process will work on me also. I'm not so special. Like, otherwise, if we think it won't work for me, then we really have to have a super high opinion of ourselves. Krishna spoke this Gita on the battlefield of Kurukshetra at the beginning of Kali Yuga so that it would be written down by Vyasadeva, so that the whole Kali Yuga can take advantage of it. Now, within this Kali Yuga, everybody can take advantage of this Bhagavad Gita, go back home, back to Godhead. But I'm so special, I don't fit in that category. I'm my own unique tattva, that this process won't work on me. Right? So even though we're thinking that it's because of I'm so useless, and we're so unsure, unconfident, means we would call this, you know, what's it? Yeah, self-confidence. We would generally say that the ego is very small, right? If I say, oh, I'm so fallen, this process won't work on me, that we would think somebody is very humble in that. No, this is the most proud person. Because they think they're so special that it won't work on them, even though Krishna says it will. So even though it looks like it's just another form of ego, but it's just Some get a taste of ego that are so confident of themselves and think I am the ability. And this is just someone who gets the taste of thinking I'm so useless. Right? Both are thinking of themselves day and night. Right? The one, I'm so great. Did you hear? Oh, I did this today. You know, what do you know, like this. And the other one is, oh, I'm so useless and I'm so this and I'm so that. And when they're with somebody else, all they do is talk about themselves and I'm so this and that. And everybody's got to come and take care of them because they feel so useless. And if you don't, they're going to have an emotional meltdown or, you know, just something, you know, bad. But they're totally self-centered. It's just the opposite, you know, attachment and rejection. Someone's so attached, it comes to the point where they reject. Right? The Mayavadi is so attached to position and fame and everything in the material world, he can't get it that he rejects it. Right? Like that. So in the same way, we're so attached to our ego, it doesn't work the way we want. Therefore, we take the opposite. In any case, we're always absorbed in thinking of ourselves. So one has to be very careful of that, that it will work, the process. So therefore, one who knows, understands this, knows that someone who's following the process will attain perfection. It's just time, that's all. And Prabhupada says previously that a pure devotee is made by associating with pure devotees. So therefore, if you feel yourself is more advanced, then you should associate with the person and help them. And if you feel you're not, then one, why you're making the comment anyway, and two, then, you know, why don't you move aside and let others who can help them do something rather than sit around and criticize. So it's like Krishna's very straightforward here in all this. He's very straightforward. Therefore, he makes his points. But even a straightforward point is made very pleasantly with very nice language. That's the thing of Sanskrit. It's a very high-class language. So even a strong point, it's just by the ending you use, the tense you use, the particular word you picked. You know? So we may not appreciate the strongness of the points, but Prabhupada points it out. It's very emphatic. He says the words Sadureva, he is saying, they are very emphatic. He doesn't say, this is emphatic, or Krishna strongly makes this point. He says, are very emphatic. So we may just say, well, sadhureva, just eva is, you know. But the way it's put together, in Sanskrit, this means very emphatic. Right? So like that, we have to accept the opinion of the acharyas. Otherwise, we're only left with our own mind. Right? And of the two, it's advised to pick the directions of the acharyas and of Krishna. Because here, even Krishna himself directly is just saying. So the devotee is the best. So whatever he's taken up, it's there. You know? Otherwise, if it wasn't a useful point, why are so many chapters of the Bhagavatam, which is the essence of all the Vedic literature, wasted on ajamya? Because he's an example of the second half of the verse, means he didn't even get it together in his life. He was a nice devotee, fell down, and then could not get it together. Right? So then, that point is being made. He didn't get it together. But why would he, chapter after chapter goes into this? Right? And we see, he became perfect. Like that. So it's the point is made in the Gita, and the example is given in the Bhagavatam. Bharat Maharaj is given as an example. Ajamiya is given as an example. Like this. So many situations. Right, Kasyapa. Now that we badmouth Kasyapa because he fell down with his wife. You know, Diti conceived the pregnancy of demons in the evening because it was improper time and that, because it was just due to lust and desire for position. So now that we badmouth him. No, a few chapters down the line, he's the father of God. Vamanadeva comes as a son. So it's, you know, one is not taking these things over seriously. If one is in a position to help somebody and direct them, then one does that. If not, then it's not our business. We have our own, determination to fix and our own sadhana to practice. It's just when we have other desires, then we will justify. Otherwise, the process is work. That's why the Bhagavatam and the Chaitanya Charitamrita are there. Even the Gita. It's showing how someone in a position that is not necessarily perfect comes to the perfectional platform. Gita starts off with as an attached, Kshatriya Grihastha. He's attached to his family, attached to his family traditions, attached to his enjoyment, is attached to his material relationships. These are all the points, arguments he gives. And it's all based on dharma, based on the shastra. But the shastra for the platform of material engagement. The karmakanda. So Krishna is telling him, then you just engage this in, take the same thing, but just remove your attachment to these things. Engage in all those things. Not do it for him. Then we see, after going through all this, and all this, from having so many doubts, The Arjuna comes to the point of being freed from doubts.
Really?
Being freed from doubts. And he does that service for Krishna. Right? So we have an example right in the Gita. Someone who had doubts, was materially attached, but came to the platform where they could follow the process. Then Bhagavatam gives so many more examples, Chaitanya Charitamrita gives so many examples. So that's the whole point of these scriptures. That's why in this age the Purana is more important than the Veda. It gives this practical example of how people attain perfection. It's just, it's very, very good. Very good point. Because it's worthwhile to note that one who does have such a difficulty, then this is the mentality he has to adopt. And if one adopts this mentality, then it makes it very easy for other devotees to not be doubtful and to accept. Because if someone becomes humble like this, then only someone very hard-hearted, or as Krishna points out in his poem, atheistic logical quibblers, or Vishwanath says hard-hearted quibblers, you know. So it's not specific. Vishwanath didn't point out here, nor did Krishna point out here, that this means this is no. All only non-devotees can't think like this. Non-devotees must think of them as sadhus. You know, this is the community of Vaishnavas. They're not Vaishnavas. They should just keep their nose out of it. But the point is being made that this is how anybody should think. So like that. So it's like... So it's basically up to this point it's come along very nicely, but at the end when Krishna becomes a little bit upset, a little angry, then he's making this point very strongly, so that those who are hard-hearted quibblers will be quiet. Like that.
What is the position of the person who is that last category? I suppose you may say like when they put the Bhagavad Gita or something.
Sure, that's he's just performing his occupational duties.
Now, in the society of, in the community of Vaishnavas, what should they do? They should ask him to live in the forest? This is not really acceptable, is it?
Means if someone has...
I mean, you may see him as a devotee, but you may see him as bright and separated.
Means one who is... able to continue performing devotional activities very nicely, even though one has had some major difficulties, then, I mean, and here the meaning major difficulties, I mean, he's giving the example of, well, someone might say, one may be considered a sadhu partially to the extent that he is worshipping Vishnu, but to the extent that he is usurping other men's wives and property. I mean, generally when our devotees have problems, they're not going to this extent. you know, very rare, you know, like this. We settle for much less of a less crimes to be, you know, great wrongs. But here he's taking very great wrongs. I mean, here, taking other men's wives and property, then in the beginning of the Gita, it's being pointed out by Krishna, these people can be killed. They're aggressors. You know, he's already said that, you know, and Arjuna says no, because they're even if our seniors become aggressors, they can't be killed. And that, now he starts to quote Dharma Shastra. On Niti Shastra, they can be killed. But on Dharma Shastra, then they wouldn't.
Kill the six aggressors there.
Yeah.
One is the house and one is the wife.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's taking it severe. He's not just saying that, you know, you ate too much Mahavishad and didn't get up Mangalarti or, you know, something like that. He's taking it to quite an extreme. Quite an extreme. And he's saying that they must be considered always like that. Then, so such a person, there will be no problem in them remaining in the community of devotees. And ideally, as long as the mood is right and the person was rightly situated in that service, then they should continue that service. Prabhupada did that so many times.
Does it mention that he's not stopping?
No, it's saying here is just like that. His determination is completely fixed. Yeah, it's a little bit mixed here, that point. Yeah, these things may still be going on to some degree, but he's fixed in the service. So he keeps doing service. He keeps worshiping the Lord, though these attachments are there. That point is made. So you could take it as someone who did something, stopped doing it. Then much of the time we'd see Prabhupada would just put them right back exactly in the position where they were. Because if that was their nature, then Krishna is saying the whole Gita is telling you, engage your nature in His service. So if you don't engage the person according to their nature, you're not following Bhagavad Gita, or you don't understand Gita. If it wasn't their nature, then you can say, okay, better they do something else. Like that. If they're having that difficulty, then it has to be seen what is the difficulty and how it can be adjusted. Like that. So they may, because in a situation where Prabhupada and someone had gotten into a problem, they told them to go to the house for some time until they could get it together and then come back. And in that way, then they can live outside. But in any case, they're still considered sadhus. They may not be acting like sadhus, but they're still within that category. And then it's those that, you know, just never gets it together. You know, up to the end of their life, just bad behavior and all this and that. Still they're considered sadhu because what they've done remains. So that substance, they became, you know, 50% advanced, that remains, that substance, that's real, that's actually them. And the 50% that's left that they're doing nonsense, that's illusions, it's not actually them, it's just mental concoction. So it's just a matter of time before that goes away. Modes of nature have their way of breaking one's determination to enjoy. I mean, because she just never gives you what you want, how you want it. Or she gives it to you, takes it away. She's expert. She knows what to do to get everybody, to make everybody miserable. If getting it will make you miserable, she'll give it to you. If not getting it will make you miserable, she'll not give it to you. Like that. She's expert. So all that has to be considered. So it's just a matter. They stay, you know, closely in the association of devotees, or, you know, they're maybe not as close until they kind of can adjust and get their own life together. Or if they're kept at a bit of a distance because they just can't interface and behave properly. But in any case, they're considered saintly. though you may deal with them according to their position, of how they reciprocate and deal with others. That's naturally, that's the social interface. But the consideration is we always consider the same. And the devotees have always done. At the same time as the person in that position then has to think in these ways. It means he gives here two aspects of how he thinks. I may go to hell or obtain an animal birth because of my unavoidable sinful reactions, but I will never give up my exclusive worship of Sri Krishna. And means, and that immediately after committing impiety, he remembers Krishna and feels remorse. Thus he quickly becomes religious. He thinks, alas, alas, there is no person more fallen than me. I defile the reputation of the community of devotees. I am damned. Again and again, feeling remorse like this, he achieves complete peace and detachment. So if that mentality can be cultivated, then one becomes situated very nicely. And if not, then it will make it more difficult for one to actually interface with the devotees, for them to interface with that person. But in no, but they're not considered not devotees like that. Just they may be, you know, not so, they're just not able to exchange properly. Interface properly with the community. But if the mentality is like this, then there's no problem. Even they come around and do service and this and that, but they should do whatever they're doing that's not acceptable outside, not within the sphere of the temple and, you know, the temple facilities. Does that make any sense? So it's nicely situated, but then starts to offend devotees. That becomes very different. Here we're talking about accidental fall down, basically into, you know, sinful activities. But if someone offends devotees, then that's more serious, because that's not a sensual problem, you know, or an emotional problem. That's a philosophical problem. So philosophical fall down is much greater than sensual, because the one sensual, it's illusion anyway, so it can be corrected by the devotional path. But if there's faith, but if there's doubts, if one offends devotees, that means there's doubts. One doesn't understand the position of devotees. One's philosophically not properly situated, so that will not help one's advancement. So the reaction is greater. It becomes an offense. The one sin is an offense. Sin goes away by performing prescribed duties in a detached fashion. Right? Even if it's not for Krishna, it will get rid of sin. Right? So let alone if you do it for Krishna, how much nicer it will get rid of sin. But offenses, I mean, they create something worse than sin. Right? Because sin, you can go to Yamaraj, and he can slowly purify you. Right? But someone who's offensive can go to Yamaraj, he can send him through all the hells he's got. Still, they won't come out any better. Like that. So offenses, one has to be very, very careful. One has to be very careful.
Thank you.
Means the Upadeshamrita is quoting how you reciprocate with the one mentally offers respect to the Kanista, one offers obeisances to the devotee, second initiated devotee who is absorbed in worshipping the deity, and one surrenders one's life to the Uttamanakari. So now, basically you have to deal with something of how it's how they're reciprocating. Because this is, see, it's the point is, all these points are based on relationship. You see the whole Gita here, Krishna's pointing out the relationship. How you're dealing with him, he reciprocates. And it's natural that you will consider somebody close that you'll always want to be with who does things like you do. Right? You know, birds of a feather flock together. So Krishna does things in a certain way. He likes his devotees to do it in that same way. But because Krishna does it in that way, then the devotees want to develop those qualities. You know, so it goes both ways. So it's a reciprocation. It's a reciprocation. So then what's happening here in this case is it's a reciprocation. Means the Kanista, one is offering respects in the mind, because many times the reciprocation is not very great. The Madhyam, that obeisances is there. One, there's more understanding on their part. The Kanista, not so much. He still identifies with the body and all that. So we may offer our respects to the super soul, like that, specifically. Also to the devotee. But at least minimum we think this to the super soul. Someone who is serving the deity. Someone who's serving the deity, then, you know, is absorbed very nicely, then they have a much broader understanding. Because it's pointed out by Kapila Muni that if you worship him in the deity form but disrespect other living entities, that worship is not considered very pleasing or very elevated. So then what we're talking about is someone who is nicely situated, who understands that other people are individuals and deals with them very nicely and properly. That's the Madhyama. So they know how to reciprocate. So one, we offer obeisances because of that advancement. Two, because that obeisances then is going to create a reciprocation. We'll offer our obeisances, then it will draw their attention, they'll offer theirs, like this. So then the rasa can be exchanged on a deeper level. And then the uttama, because of their position, then they can go even deeper. Right? So then one can surrender their life and they will protect. They will shelter. Does that make sense? So the rasa can get deeper. For the Kanista, the rasa will be very less. There's no problem in offering respects, but it's just like if you don't, but within the mind it is, then it's okay. Or this may refer also to other levels. So on a higher level may or may like that. Does that point make sense? This is the basis of it. Then we'll answer your question. Right? Now, if the person is not acting, so it's exchange. So now if they're not acting on a higher platform like that, then basically we have to reciprocate on the platform they're at. That would be the reciprocation. But that doesn't mean that this point that Krishna makes, that they're still saintly, that we don't remember all that they've done in the past, and we remember that we may not have been able to do so much. And so we have that respect there. So it will, in other words, we'll be dealing with them differently than we'll be dealing with someone else who may be acting on the same platform but has not become as advanced. You understand? Because when they're not, see, the uttama, you're surrendering your life because they're acting as one. If, you know, when Dharabara was a deer, we're not going up and accepting him as a guru. Right? because he's a deer. Right? But then, when he became Jarabharat, then we can surrender to him. Because now he's acting again. But the whole pastime, he's not being considered not a saint. You understand the point? Like that. So you have to see where they're acting and act accordingly. You know, so it becomes a very... In other words, one has to cultivate these concepts of Vaishnava etiquette in that to be able to reciprocate properly. Like that. But one can't accept necessarily... One has to be very careful then of instructions that they match nicely with Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. If they're in line with that, fine. If they're not, then they don't have to be accepted. Like that. So one has to use the discrimination. But as far as etiquette and dealings and all that, generally that will always be very nice. It's just a matter of surrender and acceptance of this instruction. But etiquette, you know, that's fine. Even someone's seems like we've seen many times, it's like that you have some, you know, senior devotee, they've been gone for, you know, so long, they happened to visit the temple, you know, but they were, you know, some very prominent or senior person. You know, generally you won't, it's, they may be not acting as that kind of, on that kind of service and understanding at the present time. But it's not that, you know, they stand in the back with the new bhaktas, because the new bhaktas live in the temple and are following everything like that. No, you generally put them right at the front with the other senior persons. Right? And depending upon the position, they may be even offered things first. If there's someone who has some other element to be senior to them, you know, like someone else's, you know, the president or GBC or sannyasi or just who joined before them or like that, then those considerations, you put them first, but they'll be counted in amongst the senior devotees and how you're going to deal with them on the social level, the level of etiquette. You know, they would take prasad with those devotees and, you know, things like that. But as far as listening to instructions, that one might avoid altogether. You know, one would be, you know, pleasant and nice, and as long as they're not being offensive or, you know, and they listen as they caught you and are explaining their philosophy or whatever it is, or whatever their opinions are. And, you know, but afterwards it's just, you know, in one ear out the other. But if they're not behaving properly and they speak badly, then you may excuse yourself, you have something else to do, or just, you know, tell them, you know, it's like this kind of stuff, you know, I'm too, what do you call it? I'm not advanced enough for all. I don't understand these things. I'm new around here, and you know, it's like, it doesn't matter. I can't figure it out. I'm just in some way finessing. Does that make any sense? Something? Is that that we have to remember what Krishna's instructions are and what he wants. Otherwise, then we just become reactive with what we're doing. In other words, what the modes of nature are arranging for us, then we react with that rather than deal as Krishna's instructions. between accident and an intentional karma. I think that's the difference between, I think it's answered, Dr. Jagannathan who made that point. So it's, in other words, kind of just, there's a great danger in the beginning, you know, I mean, at least at some stage of whatever the habits are of this life, of getting re-involved in them. You know, and habits of this life are based on desires of previous lives, though they've been cultivated in this life. So the fundamental points of coming from previous lives. Intentional here, which is the point that's made, that's being very strongly spoken against, is the point of one thinks I'm a devotee, so I can do anything, so I can even perform all these things and just carry out devotional service. That becomes the seventh offense of the holy name. That's considered the most abominable. It's not the worst. The worst is the first offense of offending devotees. Like that. Because that totally destroys a people. But this is the most abominable. You just take advantage. In other words, someone is very kind and merciful, and then you take advantage of that. No one appreciates that. You know? And he's saying, biting the hand that feeds you. So Krishna is being so broad-minded here, and the acharyas are being so broad-minded, and then you take advantage of that, then it's like, that's disgusting. Someone has a fall down, then that's unfortunate. The modes of nature are very powerful. And until basically one comes to the Brahma-Bhuta platform, it's a strong danger that one can, you know, become bewildered by the modes. And even on the Brahma-Bhuta platform, sometimes we can make mistakes because the principle of attachment still remains. Right? The principle of attachment still remains. So in the platform of Brahma-Bhuta, it hasn't been totally transferred to Krishna. It's kind of like a neutral. It's not in the material world. We partially put it in Krishna, but we haven't fully. Because fully means then prema. Right? Bhava means partially, like a bud. It's not fully opened. You know, the fragrance is not there. You know, the full beauty is not there. Like that. But its potential is there. It's almost there. It's just a matter of time and it opens. Like that. So it's one can still fall, as Bharat Maharaj is the example. But otherwise, yeah, that tendency is there.
Another thing is that sometimes, like when it's at a high position, it falls down, and because the devotees are not acting like that, they don't see that person. And that person starts feeling resentful and starts criticizing the devotees. And what is his position now?
It becomes difficult because the point is the living entity always has the freedom to make the proper choice, no matter what the situation is. So if one becomes, then one is not necessarily, not necessarily so remorseful. It just means that one can continue going, becoming humble. Of course, we're asking a lot, but it's possible. Then one remains glorious. Otherwise, one becomes a little less than glorious. But the service is there, and generally those kinds of things are small. You know, one has some comments about this one or that one, basically probably about the persons who make the comments about yourself. But as long as one doesn't reject the process, you know, then things will go on. Either sometime later, you know, either in this life or next, when both parties mature, then things will correct themselves. But still, one has to be very careful. There's one Sri Vaishnavacharya, he spoke on this point, is that you have someone who's done something wrong, and it's based on this point, someone who's done something wrong, then that person who criticizes them, you know, unnecessarily, it means it's not for like constructive criticism, trying to point out, you know, like Vidura is going to Dhritarashtra and saying, you know, you're just living in the house of Yudhishthira like a dog eating scraps. But that was for his benefit, to wake him up and to bring him to the proper consciousness. So it's constructive criticism. But when it's not constructive, then that person who then criticizes that first Vaishnava who made offense, I mean is an offense, the one who had difficulty, you know, had a fall down or some improper action, then the person who observes that and criticizes, that's considered an offense. Now, then a third party sees the second party criticizing the first party, and he criticizes them. That is also an offense.
He criticizes the one who criticizes.
Yes. So like that, I think you could just keep going. Because the point is that the second person, it's wrong, but it's also very natural for someone to react in that way. Because we're so conditioned that things that are obviously sinful are bad and things that are obviously pious are good, that one may react badly to an activity that is considered grossly sinful. And they will be very tolerant of pious activities. Right?
He made a slight offense.
Yeah.
First he didn't consider, when he made that, he didn't stand up, and immediately he started to consider his qualifications, really consider his birth.
Yeah, it's natural. But the thing is the difference is that it's one thing is you're making a critical statement either for the benefit of others so they will not get involved in such things, or to the person themselves, you know, so that they correct themselves. That's not, it's just criticizing just to criticize, you know, nothing better to do. That. You know, and then the second one will criticize, I mean the third one criticizes the second. So that's wrong. Because then they're also not understanding it, that it's natural as a conditioned reaction of being in the material world so long. So that may happen, they may do like that. So unless you're in a position to correct them, then it's a waste of time. Then naturally the fourth person then criticizing the third person, then it's the same thing, so it just keeps going. So it has to be very, very careful. Speak properly, deal properly with who. That's one difficulty with also generalizations. You know, either personal points or generalizations. The personal point means you're dealing with the conditioned nature of the person, you're not actually dealing with the person themselves. Right? And if you make a general point, then it becomes impersonal, so you can't really adjust it according to etiquette. So it makes it hard to deal with generalizations like that. So one has to be very careful in both. So one tries to avoid either of those. One understands you know, looks for the good in the individual and understands the tattva or position of the general point, then it becomes, life becomes easier, better.
Good. In the first verse, Krishna says, by this, you can that get direct perception of the self by realization.
In this chapter or another chapter?
Yeah.
Isn't it second?
Hmm?
Second verse. Maybe the second verse.
Yes, the second. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting. It is joyfully performed.
How did that, it gives direct perception of the self by realization, how did that come out in this chapter?
is when you perform activity in devotion, you get realization. That's the point. When the sambit is combined with ladini, then sandini gives realization. So this chapter is telling how to perform your activities, always being conscious of Krishna, for Krishna. So it gives direct perception of self by realization. It means the previous is you're getting direct perception of self by knowledge. That's what Vishwanath points out. In all the other chapters before this, when it says knowledge, it means knowledge. Like that. But, you know, specifically Sambandhayan. But he says in this, when he says knowledge, you should always read it as devotion. So this should be this devotional service is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is, you know, it is the purest of devotion because it gives direct perception of self by realization. It is the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, is joyfully performed.
Because the self was defined in the last chapter as constitution.
Well, there's the aspect of there's the situation of the jiva is Brahman, and then the other was the how do you say
the nature
meaning is servant of Krishna. So this gives direct realization of that. It means that how you are Krishna's servant. It means direct means that you actually understand. So it's very, very, very powerful. So that's the recommendation. It's also interesting, is the perfection of religion. So when Krishna says sarva dharmam paritya, it means kick out all material considerations of religion and keep this.
So any religion is a perfection if you understand yourself.
Yeah.
With devotion.
Means, and the more the devotion is there, the more it becomes perfect. You know, it's perfect, meaning that it's sat, but you can always, how you say, expand that, especially the quantity. You know, it's like we do anything. Let's say in a day we remember Krishna for 5 minutes. That 5 minutes is eternal. It's sat, but you know we can still expand it for another 23 hours, 55 minutes. So it's perfect, but we could still improve it like that. So that's where the difficulty comes, because we're so used to activities that you perform the activity, when you come to the conclusion you get the result, then it becomes perfect. You know, like I'm cooking, I have to finish cooking, only then I get the result. But devotional service is so nice that no matter what stage it's at, it's already perfect. It's just becoming more and more and more perfect. So it's just, you know. So even though one starts on Sakam Karma Yoga, still because it's being done for Krishna, it's perfect. But more perfect than that is Nishkam. Right? More perfect than that is where we come to the actual point where we're always meditating on Krishna, always absorbed in Krishna, in the Brahma Bhuta platform, the Bhava. In other words, means the on the platform of Vaidhi Sadhana, it's perfect. When we come to Raganuga Sadhana, it's more perfect. When we come to Bhava Sadhana, it's more perfect than that. And then when we come to Prema, then it's reached as perfect as we can know in this world. So because it's being done, it's perfect. At the same time, as there is a gradation of the stages. You know, within perfect, there is gradation. But it's all sat. So it's all eternal. Making sense?
Therefore, one is rightly situated, you said.
Yeah, one is rightly situated. Because he's situated in the platform of sat. He's trying to do it for Krishna. Though these other things may be there. Just like we understand that Sakam Karma Yoga is not as good as Nishkam. So when one's done something wrong, that means there's a very strong desire So it's that aspect will be there. So Krishna's not saying he's perfect. He's saying he's rightly situated, and he will become religious and righteous and peaceful very soon. It means it's going on now. He's in the process of becoming. So it's going on. So it's because of that nature. That's the difficulty, is because it's dealing with something we're not used to. So it's hard to...
If one can have that realization, you become very much satisfied.
Yes.
Every
moment. Because then one's not bothered, you know? Because it's just like you have a good, like, nursery school teacher. I mean, the kids are just doing crazy stuff all day. But the teacher, because of the, you know, natural affection for the children and understanding their nature, doesn't mind. Right? But the kids themselves are fighting and munching each other and can't tolerate each other, and this one stole my cookie and that one stole my milk, and, you know, all this stuff is just going on. You know? And the teacher just irons it out, or the mother irons it out for, you know, all the kids, and like that. They're fighting amongst themselves, but she doesn't take it anyway. So if one can realize this, then no matter what's going on, it's not a disturbance. Unless it's against devotional service. Then, like Krishna's becoming angry, the devotee will become angry. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samavita Bhaktivedanta ki, Chaitanya Gaura Prabhupada ki.